Marketplace is supported by C3.ai. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
In which the Jobs story has its ups and its downs and its ups and its downs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Raymond James, tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions for clients' unique needs. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And by Hint, fruit-infused water in over 25 flavors like peach, clementine, and honeycrisp apple. No sweeteners, no calories, in stores or delivered from DrinkHint.com. And by Mimecast, offering cloud email security, Mimecast is dedicated to protecting companies from spam, phishing, and other email-based cyber threats. More at Mimecast.com. Relentless protection, resilient world.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 10th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is a thing going on in the American labor market that is not necessarily evident in the headline numbers, the latest of which, by the way, came this morning, the weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits, which, for the 25th week in a row, are, as analysts like to say, elevated. 884,000 people lost their jobs last week. But you look under the hood of the job story, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman does all the time for us, and you'll see something interesting. There's a lot of laying off, yes, but then a lot of hiring, and a lot of laying off, and a lot of hiring. Here's Mitchell.
Is your mental math reeling from all these job numbers? The pandemic has thrown us record job gains and losses. And Anne Elizabeth Kunkel at the Indeed Hiring Lab says that's partly because the initial massive shutdown in March was followed by piecemeal reopenings and reclosings.
There is so much churn in the labor market right now, and that is the nature of coronavirus. You have these clusters, cases pop up, they go down, and then it pops up in another state.
Case in point for this churn, bartender Ryan Vann. In March, he went on unemployment when the Michigan bar where he's worked for a decade shut down. It got to reopen in June with a lot of restrictions.
So we had 10 really strange days where we were trying to figure out how to run a bar. Like, I've never had to hold three bottles at the same time while wearing latex gloves.
His rehire lasted a week and a half. Business was slow, he went on unemployment, and he doesn't know when he'll go back to work. Daniel Zhao at jobsite Glassdoor says employers keep laying off millions of workers in sectors that are still reeling, while at the same time,
employers are needing to hire to meet new shifts in consumer demand.
Small business owner Lenore Estrada has gone through this dance multiple times. She runs a bakery in San Francisco. She laid off most of her 26 employees when COVID hit in March. Then in April,
we got PPP. And so at that time, we brought back a bunch of people.
Meanwhile, she shifted her business from baking for companies like Google to doing more deliveries and farmers markets and teaching baking classes.
We sort of needed to hire some new people with different sets of skills.
In August, her PPP money ran out and she did some more layoffs. She says it's not clear what the fall and the holiday season will bring. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There is some churn going on in retail, too, a sector that, as we have been telling you, has been getting clobbered. The New York department store chain Century 21 has filed for bankruptcy. We learned that today. Says it's going to close all 13 of its stores. But Chapter 11 bankruptcy doesn't always mean a business is going out of business entirely. It can restructure and survive, and that is looking like what's happening for much-troubled JCPenney, which has found some interested buyers, mall operators Simon Property Group and Brookfield. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what they might be seeing in JCPenney.
For more than a decade, JCPenney has been struggling. It's had multiple CEOs, and it's repeatedly tried to reinvent itself. It even got kicked off the New York Stock Exchange because its stock price went too low for too long. And yet, here we are. Simon and Brookfield want to buy JCPenney. Maybe they believe they can finally turn the company around. They have other reasons, too.
They don't want a bunch of empty stores in their malls.
Lauren Biedelsbacher teaches marketing at Babson College.
if JCPenney were to completely liquidate, they would close over 600 stores, and it would be really hard for the property managers of those malls to fill all of those spaces.
JCPenney's stores would be especially hard to fill because they're enormous, multi-level spaces. And well, what are the alternatives? Sears is out. Macy's is closing stores. David Marcotte is a consultant at Kantar.
Kohl's has never been interested in being an anchor. And you can go through the list.
And Simon and Brookfield really can't let these stores go empty. Because they're anchor stores. They bring foot traffic to smaller retailers, the Bath & Body Works and phone repair kiosks.
If I close an anchor store, I'm almost sure to lose another 5 to 10 stores at that end of the mall.
And to collect less rent money from the ones that are left. Because in mall lease agreements, there are often terms that say if an anchor store leaves, the small stores get to pay less in rent. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more down than up. Way more down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You've seen the pictures, right, from San Francisco yesterday. Orange skies, so dark from wildfire smoke, it's like the sun never even bothered to come up. Up in the mountains and the foothills, all up and down the West Coast, fires like the ones we are having now are becoming the new normal. And capitalism has noticed. In a lot of places, it's getting increasingly expensive to insure a home against fire damage. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on that.
Californians living in areas with high wildfire risk increasingly face this predicament. Their insurance policies aren't being renewed.
Insurers, you know, are stressed, and so you'd expect them to pull back on those areas.
Lloyd Dixon is a senior economist at the RAND Corporation. He says in California, Oregon, and Washington, homeowners still have options through what's known as the FAIR plan, basically an insurer of last resort. But he says there are drawbacks.
You know, often the FAIR plan's more expensive and the coverage is more limited.
But it's some coverage in a shrinking market. Janet Ruiz is with the Insurance Information Institute, a trade association. She says because rates are regulated, some insurance carriers aren't able to charge enough to cover the increasing risk of wildfires.
You can imagine carriers are looking at their books and making sure they have the right amount of money in reserves to pay out claims.
And as climate change accelerates and wildfires on the West Coast keep growing, the historical data traditionally used for rate calculations is just no longer an adequate predictor, says Jeff Slegelmelch. He's the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University.
So if we're looking at the last 10 years, that's not actually going to give us a very good picture of the next 10 years.
He says as wildfires continue throughout the West Coast, insurance in vulnerable areas will only get more expensive and harder to find. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Election Day is still technically a couple of months away, but the election is actually happening now. Some states have their mail-in ballots in people's hands already. In-person early voting is going to start soon, and state and local elections officials are preparing for a big turnout on November 3rd as well. But pandemic, right? That makes voting in person tricky. So a lot of communities are embracing a new kind of polling place, the voting supercenter, if you will. Because why try to pack people into church lobbies or school cafeterias when convention centers and sports arenas are mostly sitting empty? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The push to turn arenas and stadiums into polling places started months ago, but has picked up steam since NBA players demanded the league get on board with the effort. David Becker is executive director of the nonprofit Center for Election Innovation and Research.
The professional sports teams and the colleges, when they're getting involved, are essentially donating those facilities, and that might mean volunteering some of their staff and personnel to help out.
Like people to stock the bathrooms and help move the crowd along, keep the lights on.
There's some real advantages also in the sense that these stadiums and arenas tend to be on public transportation routes. They're very large. They can accommodate social distancing. They have really good power, lots of outlets that machines can be plugged into.
all of which describe D.C.'s Capital One Arena, one of dozens of voting supercenters being set up in large venues across the country.
We're sandwiched right between two metro stops, so very easy for anybody in the area to get here and depart.
David Tuohy is president of venues at Monumental Sports and Entertainment, which owns the arena and three area sports teams, the WNBA's Washington Mystics, the NBA's Wizards, and the NHL's Capitals. A concourse that runs the length of a city block will become a polling place, roughly five times the size of some of the city's largest pre-pandemic.
Right near the registration is the Caps hockey stick display. They'll walk by a Mystics display. They get to walk by the Wizards 1978 NBA championship trophy.
In normal times, renting out the arena could cost upwards of $100,000 a day. But for the election, the company is basically donating the space and some staffing.
It's a silver lining, if you will, of the teams not playing, being able to offer this. All the different things that make it unusual for us in this time make it a perfect fit for what is unusual for the election time as well.
This is one of five voting supercenters that will be opening in Washington for the election. Michael Bennett, chair of the D.C. Board of Elections, says they'll be in the baseball stadium, in university gyms, big convention hotels.
The voter turnout that we think that we're going to have, these will all be needed.
The city is encouraging people to vote by mail, and Bennett asked the D.C. government to provide him with an additional 120 people to help process those ballots. And there's other new costs that come with the pandemic, cleaning supplies and PPE for poll workers, and more voter education than usual.
So we're doing a lot more advertising, a lot more focus on ensuring that people know where to go and what to do to make sure that the voting is as simple and smooth in the process.
And as safe as possible in this unprecedented election. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we will postpone until May. Now we're postponing to October.
The Hollywood production pandemic postponements continue. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh my goodness, the Wawa's. Dow Industrial's down 405 points today, about 1.4%, closed at 27,534. The NASDAQ retreated 221 points, almost 2%, finished at 10,919. The S&P 500 reversed 59 points, about 1.7%, ended at 33.39. We spent $232 million on vinyl records in the first half of this year, $130 million on compact discs. The Recording Industry Association of America says it's the first time since 1986 that LPs topped CDs. Not to spoil the retro analog party here, because I'm sure your reissued monophonic vinyl Beatles albums sound fabulous, but Spotify reported annual revenue of $7.4 billion last year. Credit Suisse upgraded the digital music company stock today. Spotify up about 1%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sarah Cliff is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, does mostly health policy stuff. She is also a mom whose toddler's daycare had a coronavirus outbreak. So she set about trying to find a place to get him tested. And therein, a Twitter thread and a story in the newspaper were born. Sarah Cliff, thanks for coming back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we should say, first of all, your son is fine. But this whole episode for you set in motion a chain of reporting events that led you to some interesting conclusions about, first of all, kids and testing in this economy. Lay out what you found.
Yeah, it really surprised me when I was trying to get my son tested how hard it was to find a testing site that would see a toddler. And I'm in the lucky position when I find something weird about the healthcare system, I can spend my days exploring the answer to how things ended up that way. And what I learned is that we really have a dearth of pediatric coronavirus testing in the United States. You know, a lot of these testing sites independently for different reasons, because they didn't have a specialty in pediatrics, because of patient privacy concerns, decided not to test children. But that kind of leaves us in a situation where schools are reopening and it can actually be pretty hard for kids to get tested for coronavirus.
And the catch, of course, is that the young kids are the ones who need the most care, right? And people have full-time jobs, and you know how to navigate the American healthcare system probably better than most, and yet it was still challenging for you.
Right. I just ended up spending, you know, a half day trying to figure out where I could get my son tested. And that's a half day when my daycare was closed because there'd been coronavirus at my daycare. And I think one of the other things you're seeing is a number of childcare facilities and schools, they've set up policies where if a child is symptomatic, you know, and that could be a runny nose or a cough, they can't come back until they have a negative coronavirus test. Mm-hmm. And that could put parents in a real catch-22 situation where you need the negative test to get your kid back to childcare. That's another burden on working parents who have already found themselves pretty burdened throughout this whole pandemic.
Yeah. Can we back out for a second and sort of take a bigger picture view? And I want to talk about a story you had on in the paper today about people getting stuck with testing bills for what they thought was a free COVID test. And yet these things run conceivably in the many hundreds or thousands of dollars, and people are sort of without recourse. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is something I've been looking into over the past month or so. You know, what I found examining a number of patient bills is that a lot of patients are being charged for these things, and a lot of it just comes down to the complexity of our healthcare system, where a provider might not code the visit the right way and the insurance company doesn't realize it's a coronavirus test, or a provider tacks on a few extra tests that the patient didn't even realize was being ordered. So we have this really complex medical system that is set up to bill patients, but it is not set up to make one service, you know, completely free of charge. And patients across the country, they're finding the loopholes and the shortfalls in these rules that are meant to protect them.
Okay, but here's the policy question that I'm going to ask you to bring your experience to bear on here. We have a public health crisis in this country, and yet what we are seeing through reporting like yours and others is that the lack of a uniform system or a uniform policy is actually making the health crisis in this specific instance worse. Is that fair?
Oh, I think that's totally fair. You know, we don't have a national health service in the United States like Canada does or like Britain does, where they can, you know, make decisions from the top down. We have testing sites across the country that decide what age kids they're going to test. And we have insurance companies who decide, okay, here's how we're going to figure out how to cover the coronavirus tests. And it just creates this climate where testing can both be difficult to access in the case of kids, and it can be quite expensive in really the case of anybody.
Sarah Cliff at the New York Times, she's an investigative reporter there, does a whole lot of healthcare and comes on this program every now and then. Sarah, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Today's offering for the economic record books, and I'll tell you, we are going to need a bigger book for the good records and the bad. But today's entry is mortgage rates. A 30-year fixed mortgage could be had this week for an annual interest rate of 2.86%, the lowest since Freddie Mac started keeping track almost 50 years ago. Rates like that are part of the reason that people are buying homes despite, you know, the economy. But there is more going on here than just that. Because the dividing line between who makes it through this pandemic financially and who doesn't could well come down to one thing, whether you rent or own. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
Gina DeSantis shares a century-old colonial in Lakewood, Ohio, outside Cleveland, with her two dogs, Finn and Faye.
Hi, buddy.
Good girl.
DeSantis runs a pottery studio where she sells her work and offers classes. In mid-March, along with most of the country, she had to shut down.
There was a month with absolutely no income. And then there was, you know, about five figures worth of refunds I had to do.
Suddenly, what had been a pretty affordable mortgage payment, $900 a month, wasn't. So she called her bank.
So I was able to get that deferred originally for 3 months and then found out they'd actually extended it for 6 months, which has been amazing.
The technical term for amazing is forbearance. Congress has made it available to anyone with a federally backed mortgage. Right now, nearly 4 million mortgages, about 7%, are on hold for up to a year. And borrowers don't have to cover the missed payments until the end of the loan, which could be decades from now. Making home ownership
a piggy bank like none other at this moment in time.
That's Susan Wachter. She teaches real estate finance at the Wharton School. She says forbearance is just one piece of the homeowner advantage. With house prices continuing to rise, homeowners have more equity to fall back on. Those with good credit can refinance at record low interest rates, reducing their monthly payments. Also, as always, that interest is tax deductible.
And by the way, there is another advantage to being a homeowner, and that is you've got a home. And you've got space, probably, to wait out the pandemic.
Protecting homeowners has become a priority in light of the Great Recession, when home prices collapsed and 10 million people lost their homes. Jacob Rue at Brigham Young University says policymakers learned from that.
That it just causes massive economic calamity to have so many people lose their homes to foreclosure. So the real threat today is evictions.
Which he says is another calamity in the making. Before the CDC issued a national moratorium on evictions through the end of the year, an estimated 30 to 40 million renters were at risk of being forced out of their homes. And when that moratorium lifts, all the back rent will still be due. There's no 30-year deferment plan.
And of course, a higher share of Americans rent their homes now than, you know, a decade ago, especially people of color.
Even as home ownership has grown, only about half of Black and Latino households own their homes, compared to three quarters of white households. And ownership doesn't pay off equally. In Black neighborhoods in particular, houses tend to appraise at lower values and appreciate more slowly, creating less equity. Michael Neal researches housing policy at the Urban Institute. He says this crisis could widen the wealth gap for people of color.
They were entering this recession already more vulnerable because of those structural barriers. Then the recession hits, and that could potentially just wipe them out.
And something else we know from the financial crisis, it may take those households a lot longer to recover. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Filming in Hollywood, be it movies, TV, or streaming, well, there hasn't been much of it in the past 4 to 5 months, right? But LA has started to see an uptick in film permit applications, and there is, you might say, a sense of optimism. But the billion-dollar question is, as this pandemic drags on, how is Hollywood going to manage safety protocols and actual production? As Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports, it is complicated.
It's hardly back to business as usual. COVID safety courses are often required before arriving on set. Locations must have enhanced ventilation. Shooting days are limited to 10 hours and lots of other precautions. Comedian Kiki Melendez says,
if you have a prop and you have to give it to the other actor, they disinfect it before you give it to the other actor. You have to take a COVID test every couple of days. You know, they're doing everything in their power to make it work.
That's good news for California, where more than a quarter of a million people in the arts have filed for unemployment assistance since the pandemic began. From July to August, film permit applications in the city were up by 40%. Most of the uptick in filming is for commercials. For a lot of actors with TV and film roles, the wait continues. Ada Luz Pla is an actress on shows like Sons of Anarchy and On My Block.
My husband?
Boyfriend?
I answer to no one, let alone a man.
She has work lined up on a show right now. It just keeps getting delayed.
Pandemic hit. We were postponed until May. Now we're postponed until October.
She says the vibe in LA right now is hurry up, but wait. There's still a lot of starts and stops. Some productions that were ramped up got shut down again due to COVID cases, and that has prolonged the mood of uncertainty. Just last week, filming of The Batman came to a halt because star Robert Pattinson tested positive for COVID. Which is scary for people in the industry, says Duncan Crabtree Ireland with SAG-AFTRA, the Screen Actors Guild.
But what I would say is it's also a sign that the system is working. The testing was conducted, the test results came in, and the people in charge made appropriate decisions.
So for Hollywood right now, it's lights, camera, and some action. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Citigroup finally joins the 20th century. Yes, 20th, because the bank's news today is kind of way overdue, even though it's the first big Wall Street bank to have this news to share. Citi announced today that Jane Fraser is going to be its new CEO come next February. Obviously, the first woman to run a Wall Street bank ever. Big deal? Yes, but it is worth a mention here that according to research quoted by the New York Times today, there are just 31 female CEOs in companies that are included in the S&P 500 stock index. Okay, we are going. Here's your moment of economic context to round out the program today. Saw this in The Economist. It's a survey from the Harvard Business School about business meetings in this age of Zoom. And this matches my experience. I'll be curious to see what you have to say. The number of meetings the average person goes to now is up 13% compared with the before times. The number of people in the average meeting, also up 13.5%. Mercifully, meetings are 20% shorter, 12 minutes on average, than they used to be. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.